Welcome to theconversation.org, making sense of these times.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be great.
This show is brought to you by MightyCompanions.org. And now your host, Suzanne Taylor.
I'm here with Jim Drever today, a wonderful new friend that I've met via the internet, a stomping ground to find the heroes. And Peter Russell has dropped by, whom we all know from Global Brain and White Hole in Time and Waking Up in Time. Peter's visiting, so I told him, oh, come and sit in on this conversation that I had thought I was just going to be having with Jim. Jim has written a wonderful book called The Way of Harmony. What I was attracted to when we met in email, which I think is the most wonderful place to make fast connections to people, somehow as we meet people in our social circumstances, it takes a while to get through the protocols of formal politeness before you get intimate, but in email it seems you can get intimate really fast, like you find something you like, as Jim found my website, and he emailed me, oh, love your website, and immediately we're in it, you know. And I get that somebody who sees me is talking to me, and I see him. So what is it that I am seeing? Let me talk a little bit before we let you talk, Jim. It seems to me that there's a progression going on in this discovery of who we are and what we're doing here, what being human is all about. And we're on an interesting edge in that process now, where we're taking, you might say, God inside, where we've worshipped God in the most recent past, putting it outside and looking to get there, unite with it, join with it. The wave of now is, it is us. And as Punjiji has said in one of his more famous quotes, Punjiji, whom I have spoken about on some of these other shows, when they asked Punjiji, what gets in the way of finding God, his answer was seeking. So the minute you're looking for it somewhere, anywhere, you're immediately on sort of the wrong track, and the objective is to just open to what you discover inside yourself. Ah, there it is. What I've been looking for is me. And in the progression that we're in of working in that thought form, a lot of teachers are out there now. A lot of them sent out by Punjiji to teach. He died the same day as Mother Teresa, however many short years ago that was. And he sent out a whole lot of teachers. And most of them are still sitting in front of the room, and people somewhat at their feet, even though they're teaching people that they're each God. But what attracts me is the kind of teaching that's emerging now. And one of the names I have that seems comfortable to me is to think about this as everyday God. Here we really are. It is us. And it's a different stance when someone who's very aligned with that understanding comes along and who becomes a teacher, as Jim is. He stand up and he will lecture. He was at the Bodhi Tree here, our big bookstore, metaphysical bookstore, when he came to Los Angeles a couple of months ago. But he's also just a real person. And we're able to just be people together without that sense, any sense of separation that I am invited to pay homage to, or that I feel a distance from so that I would pay homage to. Because as we do involve ourselves in this whole awakening process, the place that we come to really is this place of spiritual camaraderie and fellowship, where we really are all on the same level. And I'm so attracted to, it's still a teaching when somebody's very clear. But it's not a hierarchical teaching. It's a heart-to-heartness that goes on that, to me, Jim is quite the embodiment of. Do you experience yourself to be juxtaposed to the other teachers in this kind of accessible way? Do you know what I'm talking about, or is it so much just who you are that you don't even get a distinction?
Well, gosh, that's a, you know, the phrase was going through my mind. We talked about this before, the democratization of enlightenment. We talked about an individual who was with a well-known teacher who's very hierarchical, who sits at the top of the pyramid and is disseminating the teachings of enlightenment to his students, but none of them ever actually get enlightened. And when this particular individual finally left after 20 years, the teacher threatens him with lifetimes of hellish karma. It's something that I don't think I struggle with anymore, but I did for quite a while. There is a teaching, I mean, and there are a number of different spiritual teachings which serve to bring us back to our true nature. And so somebody who is presenting a teaching, I suppose, nominally is a teacher, but I was like really influenced by Krishnamurti, for example. He was my first major inspiration. And he was very much, you know, the anti-guru guru, in fact. I mean, he had his followers, and
I used to laugh sitting at Miner's Oaks there, listening to him saying that you mustn't follow me, and all this huge audience of people, quote-unquote, following him.
Well, I know, and he did have, and I talked about my friend John Allen, who was in small private groups with him up in Ohio, because John was teaching at the Krishnamurti School, but Krishnamurti, Elvis Huxley started, and it was the Happy Valley School. You know, people got to say something, Krishnamurti would kind of, you know, stop them. I mean, he was very much in control of the group.
But he did, I did understand what he meant was, he didn't have a retinue that was, you know, at his, you know, kissing his feet and all that sort of thing.
No, in India, people would kiss his feet, because that's what they do in India, and he would get uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking last night about, you know, how I recognized that part of my shadow was the sort of need I'd had for attention when I was, like, really young, that started at a young age. And that probably when I started out lecturing, and back when I was in the army and so on, I enjoyed the attention that one gets from being a teacher, being on stage. And yet, there's also this genuine joy that I've always had in just sharing something that I see, which I think is one of the hallmarks or characteristics of the true teacher. I think I learned something about how to kind of deal with this through Jean Klein, who we've talked about, who was my main spiritual mentor or influence, and he would say, you know, yes, there is ostensibly a student-teacher relationship, but you must never take yourself to be a teacher. And just like you're saying about Rinpoche-ji, that it's the attachment or identification with being a seeker that keeps us from realization. We were talking about that last night, how the having an identity as a spiritual seeker gives us a lot of juice and meaning and can kind of keep us going for years or decades. Ramana Maharshi said, you know, the only barrier to self-realization is the belief that we're not realized. It's these kinds of attachments that, and particularly the attachment or the identification of being some kind of a teacher, that perpetuates the old guru-disciple of somebody's up here and other people are down here. And using the internet as a metaphor, I think that enlightenment or self-realization, the awakening to who we are, waking up in time, you know, the title of Peter's book, which I really like. We are consciousness becoming aware of itself. That's how I see this process.
Beautiful.
As consciousness wakes up in more people, we will realize, as we were saying last night, that we really are manifestations of the one energy. We can call it the one divine energy. And to really see that, and so I catch myself, if I find a judgment arising about somebody, I'm more and more immediately reminded of what I'm about, what I stand for, which is this notion of all being manifestations of the one consciousness, which is what quantum physics, I mean, no more the physicist, but it seems to me that that's what modern physics is telling us, that there is only consciousness, and all this is a manifestation of consciousness. Wait, is that so, Peter? Would you like to say something about that?
I don't think modern physics is saying that. Modern physics has a lot of problems with consciousness.
It does.
It doesn't really know what to do with consciousness. There's a lot of metaphysical teachings that say that. You can go right back, you know, to the root to the Vedas and things like that, and you'll find them in the idea that everything is a manifestation of consciousness. No, modern physics more says everything's a manifestation of something, whatever underlies the realm of space, time and matter, and consciousness somehow manifests from that. They don't quite know how. I think that's the big problem with modern physics. So that's a whole other story.
Well, we'll do another interview on that.
That's my new book, I've just finished.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Do you know David Darling, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah, because I just recently read his book, Zen Physics, and it seemed to be what he was saying, that particles only exist when consciousness is being aware of them.
Yes.
What was he meaning?
But in quantum physics, and this is one interpretation of quantum physics, the problem is that I think quantum physics isn't yet really sorted itself out. It got started, well, it is 100 years ago now, 90 years ago, and was relatively the other great revolution of this century, got very clear, the mathematics got sorted out very, very clearly, and it got accepted almost immediately. Quantum physics has been in a haze ever since the beginning, and no one quite knows how to interpret these things. The fact that, I think, well, what initially people like Bohr said was, we only know where something is once we observe it. We don't actually know where it is. And that may sound simple, but the mathematics describes our knowing. Uh-huh. And what's happened today is people taking the mathematics of quantum physics to describe the external world. And when you do that, it seems as if the act of observation causes something to exist in the external world. I go along with the original interpretation, which is the act of observation causes it to crystallize in our awareness, uh-huh. which is something different.
Uh-huh.
But it's a whole vague area, a whole vague area. And let's say this, I think at the last count there's 7 different interpretations of quantum mechanics, of which the most popular one is the Copenhagen Convention, which says that the act of observation causes a particle to exist in space and time. But that's not the only interpretation, it's just the most popular one today. And I think we haven't yet sorted out quantum physics.
But we're not going to do it on this half hour, are you?
No, we're not. Because I've no idea.
But this is what you're writing about now.
What I'm interested at the moment is consciousness, the whole nature of consciousness and how science cannot handle consciousness.
Uh-huh.
Because there's nothing at all in any of current science, biology, physics, chemistry, anything, that predicts that any living organism should ever have a single interior experience. Uh-huh. There's nothing in modern science that predicts consciousness. And yet science prides itself on its predictive ability. And the one thing it can't predict is there'd be consciousness, yet without consciousness we wouldn't be doing any predicting or any science or any mathematics or anything. So I take the view that science is inside out at the moment with regard to consciousness. It's trying to explain consciousness in terms of the material world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's actually the other way around, that consciousness is more fundamental than the world of space, time and matter.
Right, which is what the Vedas were saying, and the physics, science has said that consciousness arises from the material realm.
Well, that's its belief, and the problem is it's got nowhere with that belief. That's its belief that the material world is fundamental and that consciousness arises from it. I think we need to go back and look at, it's not just the Vedas, it occurs in many, many metaphysical teachings, the idea that consciousness is fundamental. When you do that, it doesn't change physics one bit, which is good, so it doesn't actually threaten physics, but I think it opens up a whole new understanding of mystical experience, mm-hmm. because what comes out of that is the fact that space, time and matter are actually manifestations within consciousness, mm-hmm. which again is what many, many teachers have said.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a way what both quantum physics and relativity are pointing towards. I think they're actually saying that, but they're pointing towards that fact that consciousness is more fundamental.
Understanding this to me sort of comes back to what you were saying, Suzanne, this whole previously hierarchical dissemination of spiritual teachings and the path to enlightenment, this long ascent and the certain gurus or teachers who have realized their true nature sit up on the mountaintop. And yet if it's true that consciousness is true nature, then it's in all of us, whether we're just about waking up to it. And
well, it's sort of the wrong idea that we're, you know, you never get where you're going if you're going in the wrong direction, you know. I think I've got that a little backwards. But, you know, again, it's what you're looking towards, what's looking, and then you have to sort of revise everything when you get that idea. I want to go back, though, and mention for the listener that all this reference we're making to last night is that we had a gathering here with Jim as the guest of honor. And there were 20 or so people here, and so he's referencing some of the things that were said. And, you know, why do we gather? I mean, if we're not going to gather at the feet of someone who's going to tell us the way it is, and we're going to acquire some learning, why are we gathered? And I love what you were saying last night, that we were just gathered in spiritual fellowship. It's just such a nice experience to be in this presence of awareness and truth, and to share our understandings about this, and to get this feeling of connection among ourselves, and that then we're all emissaries out there in the world to shine our light, and that others pick up that light, and nothing like a good example, you know, a picture worth a thousand words.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that whole tone of it was quite lovely, Because the world we live in is so goal-oriented. You know, why are we going there tonight? Well, we'll acquire a degree or a teaching or something. And just to come to be inspired again, filled in our own hearts, reaffirmed in this more esoteric kind of understanding that isn't the way the materialistic world has been organized, that in itself is of supreme value. Mm-hmm. There was something else that I especially wanted to talk about that we didn't talk about last night, that I picked up from your book. It got me thinking. The way we've got it wired, the way we have our understanding, is that we want to cross over, you might say, to this divine, to this realization, to this place of awareness. And we could point to those credible gurus who have been so on fire and blazing with this emanation of their own awareness and consciousness, and we so want to be there. We want to be out of the hustle of all the things that concern us in the normal everyday world, and we want to be transcended into this wonderful state from which we operate our normal world. But you said something in this book, and it got me thinking, oh God, this is so fundamental, and I just never even thought of it that way. What you were talking about was, you're talking about Advaita, which is this tradition of teaching where we are becoming aware that God is inside us. And you said here, Advaita, which traces its roots 3,000 years back to the Upanishads, the great wisdom scriptures of India, is a way of shifting perception and coming back to the awareness that precedes thinking. That sentence got me. Is a way of shifting perception and coming back to the awareness that precedes thinking. So that in fact, we can be just like we are, caught in the material world or living in the material world, which has all these pushes and pulls in it, when we understand this alternative setup, that we've got a way of shifting perception. And then your next sentence is, it is a direct path to the clear, spacious mind that is our true nature, which gives rise to all that we see, feel, and experience. A direct path. So wait a minute, I'm reading. Wait a minute. Huh. It's not that I wish that I were at that final point of realization where my whole life was transcendent and everything was clear and open and clear and spacious and there I am living in that place. Wait a minute. How about that I just know this path and I know the way to shift my perception so that I have a path, not a destination, that I've got in my focus, you know, of what it is I'm doing and as I move along in life. I can invoke this. I can do it moment by moment. I can do it every moment. I can do it at periodic moments. I can do it when I realize, oh my goodness, I've forgotten who I really am. I'm stuck in this terrible scene. Wait a minute. Okay, now I'm going to invoke my way. It's just the awareness of it as a way rather than as a destination that I thought was incredibly meaningful. Now, whenever I discover something incredibly meaningful, I wonder, wait a minute, maybe everybody already knows this and I'm just making this discovery, but I don't think so. I think that everybody's trying to land somewhere where it's a done deal. We'll be enlightened. Rather than seeing, no, we live in a world that's pushing and pulling us, but we have a path, we have a way, and we can, you know, be periodically, over and over again, we can go on this path. And then, of course, you have to know how to tune yourself in. And this book, The Way of Harmony, by the way, if you want to find many, many beautiful little exercises or explanations, it's just full of ways. A Simple Approach to Spiritual, Emotional, Physical, and Material Prosperity is the subtitle of The Way of Harmony. And I'll read you. Jim Drever is a gifted teacher whose words actually bring us into the living present where the healing energy of love can be felt. That's John Allen, whom you were just talking about before, writing on the book jacket of this book. Now, do you relate to what I'm saying? Because I'm even thinking when you do your presentations, that idea might really be the driver, you know, for a lot of what you're presenting. Don't you think that people think that they're going to land somewhere, it's going to be a done deal, and that's what they're headed for?
I think that's the accepted notion about enlightenment, and I think it's actually true, that once we really wake up, will wake up. Jean Klein, who was my main inspiration, that's who carried this non-dual teaching, somebody said to him once, many times over the years, you know, so what is enlightenment? And his answer was always a variation of, it's the realization there's nobody, no one to be enlightened. Which, you know, sets most people scratching their heads. Huh? What do you mean by that? I mean, I'm here, aren't I? And, well, the person that we take ourselves to be, the psychological, emotional entity that we think we are with our story, this is my background, these are the things I'm afraid of, these are the things that I'm hopeful about, and if you relate this way to me, I'll feel good, and if you relate that way to me, I'll feel bad. It's this image we have of ourselves that gets insulted, that worries. And enlightenment is seeing that that is an illusion. That's what enlightenment is. That's the essential teaching of Advaita. What I was told, and my experience now, has been that as we see this, it kind of starts to fall away, and gradually the psychological and emotional component of thinking begins to fall away because there's no story there, there's no image holding that together. There is actually a landing place, but it's very different than what we imagine. I like to think of that Zen saying, after enlightenment, nothing changes, but everything is somehow different. And the difference is that we just don't take ourselves to be anybody anymore. I mean, in the eyes of somebody else, I may be somebody, you know, I do this work, I write books or whatever. The way I put it in the book is that when we wake up, prior to awakening, we know ourselves as, I'm Jim Drever, on this path, I have these incredible moments of oneness, of unity consciousness, but I know myself as Jim Drever first, who is seeking and having more of these experiences. When we wake up, we now know ourselves as consciousness, pure consciousness expressing through this body-mind known as Jim Drever. So we know ourselves as consciousness first and as the historical person second.
Well, I want to go further with this. Yes. I love what you're saying, and I'm so glad to be talking about this. I think this is the conversation worth having.
It's a great conversation.
It's a great conversation, but I want to pursue my thought here and see if I can be, maybe I haven't been clear, because I think I'm really also saying something else. I have that. Absolutely. And you wonder to yourself, well, can I say I'm enlightened? You know, it's such a loaded word, as you said last night. Do I dare say that? I mean, I know that in spades, all those things you've just been saying. So what accounts for the fact that I'm not Ramana Maharshi, you know, or that I'm not one of the people who are so obviously pulsing with this divine energy that, you know, you just get around them and you feel the pulse or whatever. And
well, I always feel juiced when I'm around you.
Ah, wait a minute.
How do you know you're not? Ramana Maharshi was like, he was a unique embodiment. But Suzanne Taylor is a unique embodiment, too.
Well, now I want to argue for Suzanne Taylor's unique embodiment, really appreciating this notion of the path and the way that Advaita is, because I still have to deal with the fact that I get reactive to things, that I can't imagine Ramana Maharshi used to get reactive to things. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he did.
He had a little reactivity at the end of his life when he was suffering a lot, like his body's hammering him, brought it up, but probably mostly not.
Mostly not. So there's something different about some of these other people, and yet...
But he was also sitting on a mountaintop, basically, his whole life. He wasn't here and instead of living in Los Angeles.
Okay, so let's add that to the mix.
Raising children.
Yes. All of that, yes. Right. Betrayals, all of that. Nobody was betraying him, right? Okay.
But he didn't care whether money came in or not. You probably had a mortgage to care about.
All of that. So let's bring ourselves into the world where, you know, most people live. Certainly anybody listening to this program. And the fact that this world is so problematic in so many ways, and brings you to these confusions or conflicts or emotional reactions that then seem to belie whatever your image is of somebody like Ramana Maharshi or any of the great, you know, those great sages who seem to just be the emanation of this awareness. I like the thought that the goal, let's say, my goal, isn't to be like them, and that as I'm not like them, it doesn't mean I've settled for something that I'm just not capable of going beyond, you know. But I like to think that, no, this is it. Everyday God, the democratization of enlightenment. Mm. No, wait a minute, folks. This is it. We can all just rest. We can, you know, those of us who have that kind of figure ground reversal that, you know, we've come to understand because, you know, the world we got born into didn't teach us the things you were just talking about. So here we are. We understand this. And it's very nice to think that there is a something underlying this that I can, you might say, use, or that's my tool, or even that makes it too objectified. It's like one of my teachers, one of my crazy guru teachers, used to say, "Oh God, you people, you're all on the path. There you all are on the path, struggling, while I'm over here in the bushes having a good time." Anyway, it's not quite the same thing. But just knowing that, ah yes, that through line path, it's like my witness. My witness is always there, even though I can watch for my witness and see that I am terribly stuck, you know, I'm having an episode or some such. It doesn't deny the fact that my consciousness is always there. But I love this idea that it's a way and it's a path. Not a path to arrive somewhere, but a path to accompany me. A path to always be in my, you know, in my complete spectrum. My path. Oh, yes. Oh, I'm over here. Well, in this case, I'm in the bushes lost. Oh, no, my path is, I can just, yeah, of course, my path is always there. I can laugh at myself being lost in the bushes. That was actually a terrible analogy. It was just backwards, because he's over in the bushes having a good time. Well, actually, the time I made him move out of my house was when I discovered he was beating up the girlfriend he was living with at the time. So that's who he was over in the bushes with. But that was another era. That was the 70s. We were all a little crazy then.
I want to say something about the reactivity is that, I mentioned this in a discussion last night, but Ramana Maharshi said that with self-realization is like unplugging the electric fan, but the fan keeps spinning. So even as we wake up, I found it helpful, and I learned this again from John Klein. He would talk about residue. In body work, when you get rolfed or get any kind of deep tissue body work, sometimes even chiropractic, it triggers memories. You know, our story, the sort of story that the person we take ourselves to be, over years gets locked in the cell. So once we wake up and see that we're not our story, we see it and see it and see it until we can get down to that last thing and realize that this person we're still taking ourselves to be at a subtle level is still a myth. And that sort of snaps, the identification snaps, and we realize what we have always been, which is we have always been free. But then we're still human, and these residues are like literally stored in the cells of the body, and they'll come up from time to time, so that old fears or insecurities, they're triggered, but we just see them more quickly, and we remember that that's not who we are.
Well, the residue maybe could send us back to the good part of the path, the good path,
right,
so the way, the path.
The residues.
Yes.
And if they're really strong, and we haven't really quite gotten free of that identification, then using them as a reminder that this is where we're not free. Like if we find ourselves still caught in judgment or comparison, envy, or some element of greed or something, these things are showing us where we're not yet free.
But let's not think of those as limitations, I want to suggest. And let's not think that, oh, I'm not there yet. Maybe you're not even suggesting that, so you can answer me. But let's think that those are just the human kinds of things that we might expect living in, dense material reality, that and old conditioning, and that it's not some indication that we have to do more quote-unquote work on ourselves, but as we know this way and this path, it's just a reminder that, oh, wait a minute, we've strayed a little off the path. And
right, and that's what this path is. It's a remembering that this is not who we are.
But I love the thought that you eliminate that trap or that kind of box that we've all created, those of us who are seeking, so to speak, where we think we're supposed to arrive somewhere. And I like to think now, especially after reading this, that the arrival is more the understanding that you get and the fundamental shift of figure ground, that once you see the backwards way that we've got it set up, you just don't see, you see more clearly after that. You get the idea. And that maybe that's all you really need, and just having some familiarity with the whole setup and even things like in this book, exercises to bring you back, or even the knowing of the other way, the clearer way, that accompanies you thereafter, and that you can relax and say, okay, this is enough. And who knows, in the course of doing that, you may turn into Ramana Maharshi. Who knows? But not to set that up as, oh, I'm not there yet because I'm not like that, you know. And I think most of us are doing that. We're still trying to get there.
Because we have an image of what enlightenment must be like, that it's constant bliss, no more problems.
Exactly.
And that's not it. Enlightenment is just realizing that we are what we've been looking for, that we are this consciousness expressing through these body-minds, and we're not the emanations of consciousness. They're just happening all the time. We are the source. And the problem is that we grow up, in Advaita, they call it avidya, ignorance of the forgetting, the not knowing that we are the source, and we get identified with the emanations, the projections. You know, I'm a Jew, I'm a Christian, you know, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, and because of our isolation and separateness and the insecurity that comes when you feel like a lonely wave on this ocean of waves, because you don't know yourself as the ocean, then there's a longing for some idealized kind of situation, and we project that particularly on this whole notion of enlightenment. And I think this is one of the barriers to the one of the problems. This is why the democratization of enlightenment, to use that phrase, finding ways of communicating that people really get it, because people have such ideas about what enlightenment is, that when somebody comes along and says, look, this is how you can work through and release suffering and not have to suffer again, they don't believe you because you don't, you know, fit their image of what an enlightened person is like or something.
So I think this is the most wonderful work now. Like, this is why I'm so attracted to you. This is so important, it seems to me, and really bringing us along to the next step of where we really can be successful at this thing that we so yearn for, and not feel like, you know, oh, we'll never get there, we'll never be good enough, and what have you. And to be, you know, satisfied and allows us to just kind of rest in the awareness that we have as really being the blessing that we've gotten this awareness, oh, thank God. And now we can live the life of paying more and more attention, having it less and less have things affect us, and that's it. That's the game. That's the trip. And it's not some unattainable thing that, you know, hardly any of us are ever going to get to. And
Well, that could be a trap as well.
Okay, talk.
I mean, we talk about Ramana Maharshi. I'm sure, you know, he didn't set out with some goal of getting to enlightenment, I don't think. He was on his own quest. He had his experiences, his revelations, and he explored them. But it took him years and years of deep inner exploration to come to the truth. And for him, it wasn't just an understanding. It was a deep, deep experience, which he was then able to share with people, and which made him such a celebrated soul. An analogy I often think of is like weightlessness in space. We all understand that when you go into space, you experience weightlessness, and we can understand it, we've seen films about it, we know what happens when you pour liquids in space. That doesn't mean to say that we know weightlessness. We can understand it. When you've actually been into space and experienced weightlessness, then you can describe it firsthand. And I think what the great masters are able to do is describe what you're talking about from first-hand experience, and that to me is different from the understanding which we all have. And how you can move from that understanding into first-hand experience, I think, does take a lot of deep inner exploration, because we have to undo so much of the conditioning that we all have that stops us seeing it that way, that keeps us in ignorance.
Well, I want to argue with you a little bit. I want to agree with you, and I want to argue with you. If I've got my story right, I seem to recall, as a teenager, this strange thing used to happen with Ramana Maharshi, where he would go into some kind of trance, and his friends would carry his body around and set him up places and put him, you know, carry this body that was absolutely not there, you know? There was no physical, no awakeness, you know, to this body. And I want to suggest that he's a very unusual person, and that somehow or other, in this way in which this world is full of all different kinds of people, that he got born into something that was quite different from us, and maybe further along. And so I just think that particular story is so, outside the lines, and that he is a character outside the lines. And there's no question that he has a different experience, had a different experience from me. But I think the trap is... This is probably true and false, but the trap is to think that you're supposed to be like him, and that you're not enlightened unless you have something similar to that kind of transported reality where you're absolutely in the other side of things. And I think that just happens to very few people. And yet I don't think you have to hold that as a limitation on the part of everyone else or an aspiration that everyone else should be trying to get to. Now, that doesn't mean you should settle for something that you've gotten a glimpse of something and you go around saying, oh, I got it all, I'm enlightened, because, you know, you'll never get any further. But I think there's some other way that we're not really talking about where we really can feel, we can feel satisfied, not that we've stopped at that place, but that we're at the really key, we made the key shift. And that from that shift being made and our sincere intention to be as clear and as clean and as awake as we can be for as much time as we can be, that we get better and better at it. And that we never perhaps have to get as perfect as some of the masters to really say that, no, I've really got this. And I've got it so that it's different from, you know, the acknowledged kind of reality that most of the world is in, the old story. Mm-hmm. And that we are living the new story now.
I agree with that. And in that sense, I agree that it's about the way and treading the way rather than aiming for any goal. But there's a bit of me which says it's easy to be complacent. I mean, I've been on my own spiritual path for 30, 40 years nearly. And
are you confessing to your complacent?
Yes. How easy it is to get complacent and how hard it is for me to maintain the vigilance, the discipline, how easy it is to get sucked back into the other reality. And that for me is work, it's spiritual work. And that takes a lot of dedication on my own side, and I fall out of that many, 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 many times.
Hmm. Well,
so you know, I understand a lot about what we're talking about. I've had some glimpses of that in my own experience, but for me, there's a huge gap between my understanding and that deeper experiential knowing, and I want to close that gap.
Well, I think all of this is true, to be honest with you. I find that this experience of satisfaction, you might say, is most available to me consistently when I'm with other people who are understanding what I'm understanding. And I find as I spend time with people like that, it's also obvious. It feels like whatever, as a soul voyager out there in the world of separation, I end up struggling with a lot, it feels like the struggle becomes just ridiculous. You know, you look in each other's eyes and it's a constant reminder when you're with people like that that this newer story is indeed the way it is. And I think that there's hope, you know, that we really can become an enlightened democracy and many, many people can really change their idea of how hard it is and not be shortchanging themselves in doing that and really be doing the ultimate work. Because if it's always going to be just for a few and really hard and a constant struggle, I somehow just don't think that can be it. That feels like a step on the way to it, but it feels like it's got to open to something more lovely than that. And that's what it feels like in my experience. And it feels like that's what we might all be talking more about and really reassuring each other and helping each other to see that this struggle mentality is perhaps the last step before, you know, that we can perhaps step off of and not feel so bound to, even though I certainly respect the fact that catch me on a bad day and I'm not going to sound quite so optimistic mm-hmm. about things. So maybe we can sort of leave it at...
We still have bad days.
You know, Jim, I wonder, not having a captive audience here who's sitting in front of us paying attention, but I so love that exercise that you do to separate us into this witness and give us that beautiful experience of not being our bodies, our minds, our emotions, our whatever's, and really being the witness. What do you call it? The core insight?
The core insight. And the about our story, yes.
And that wonderful exercise you do to put people into their
expanding
core.
Expanding awareness exercise, yeah.
Do you think that we can just do it in a little, you know, shorter version? I know when the first time I heard you do it, you did a lone relaxation exercise first so that we could actually just free ourselves and clear ourselves. Do you think it's possible here in this format too?
Yeah, I could probably do it in about 3 minutes, and so that anybody who's listening, if they wanted to participate, could actually listen to me giving the instructions and have the experience that, that this tool brings a person to. Wherever you are listening to this program, Just take this moment to get really quiet and still within. And then let your awareness expand and visualize that you're situated slightly behind and above your head. This is the starting point of your awareness. You are indeed this field of awareness which is expressing through this body-mind. Notice how your body lives within your awareness. You can be aware of your body, the length and the breadth of it. Then pay attention to the rising and falling of your breath, the coming and going of the breath, and how that happens within the spaciousness of the awareness that you are. The sensations and feelings in your body, notice them. Notice how the tensions and the sensations and feelings in your body shift and change. And it all happens within this vast field of awareness that is your true nature. And then pay attention to the coming and going of thoughts in your mind, the pictures, the images. These are constantly changing. Your mind is continually generating thoughts. And these too exist within your awareness. You can be aware of the thought, even the thought, I am. You can be aware of that thought. So you cannot be the thought, you are that which is aware. You are the awareness in which thoughts, in even the sense of I or me, is being generated. Be the awareness that you are. Then let your hearing expand. Notice how you can hear the sound of the plane passing overhead. Now that sound comes out of silent awareness and will momentarily dissolve back into silent awareness. Just as the sound of my voice comes out of silence and dissolves back into silence. All sound comes out of silence and dissolves back into it. And silence and awareness are one and the same. Your true nature is awareness or consciousness. Vast, infinite, silent, but ever creative, generating the experience of being you in this body, thinking these thoughts. And so that whenever you feel stuck or in conflict, you can just come back to this breathing, the sense of presence, that expanded awareness, and remember, this is who you really are. You are this awareness, expressing through this body, continually generating new thoughts, new ideas, new ways of being. And the more you come back to the sense of expansion and spaciousness and openness, the more the tension in the body will dissolve, your breathing will flow more easily, and thinking will be much more creative and won't be a problem. Just you can stop and do this at any time throughout the day, and it takes just a minute or two to remember yourself as awareness, as consciousness, this expansion, this beauty, this stillness expressing through the body movement. And that's the exercise.
Well, thank you so much for that. Now, you know, exactly a wonderful example of what I was talking about as you experience that you're on a path on, you know, that this Advaita is a path, it is a way. There we are. Little simple tune-in.
And that was actually an exercise that I got a variation of that from Jean Klein. Advaita is the teaching which is, you know, shifting the reorienting the mind and coming back to the realization that we're not our story, that we are not our personal history. Jean had studied this form of yoga called Kashmir Yoga, which was sort of very akin to the Advaita teaching, and this whole expansion of awareness and beginning to see that your body is energy and that you're not this. You know, the other side of the Advaita teaching is that we're not the person we've taken ourselves to be. And I think that's the big realization. We have this idea of ourselves, we have these ideas about enlightenment, how it must look, how it must feel. And particularly when we're early on the path, when we shift from a place of conflict and suffering and suddenly we have these epiphanies and we feel the true beauty and oneness and magnificence of life, it's a grand experience. And we think that that's what enlightenment is like, the ceaseless flow of grand experiences. But as we get clearer and clearer, and the gap between our true expanded nature and contraction and suffering diminishes, then the experience is much more even, which is why I like that Zen saying, after enlightenment, nothing changes, but everything is somehow different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, the bells and whistles and ice. And I mean, for example, just in my experience, when I met Jean Klein in 1984, I was at a place in my own process where it was easy for me to sit and meditate and get into a state of bliss. And I had begun to think that bliss was enlightenment. I could sit down, breathe, I knew how to let go of the tension in my body through my yoga and so on, and I could just feel waves of ecstasy. In fact, I talk about this in The Way of Harmony. And I remember around the time I met Jean, I was sitting meditating one morning in the house, and my son Adam, who was about 10 months old at the time, was in his crib in the next room, and Barbara, my wife, his mother, was out in the kitchen, and the bliss was just beginning to unfold. Like, yes, this is what I was wanting. This is why I meditated. And suddenly Adam started crying, and Barbara called out, "Jim, would you change Adam's diapers?" And I thought, damn it all, I don't want to get up and change his diapers. I'm just beginning to cruise here.
That's so perfect.
And then it's like, you know, some voice of truth came in and said, "Jim, you call this enlightenment? You don't want to get up and change your son's diapers, your own." And that was when I began to see that, maybe. And then I met Jean Klein, and he said, "Listen, enlightenment is not a state of bliss. It's not a state of any kind. You know, true, you know, when you relax into it, bliss is just a function of a deeply relaxed body. It's a kind of a fine kind of bliss that's always there, but sometimes it's just, you know, the body, you wake up in the morning and the body's, because of something you ate last night or something, it's not perfectly balanced and it may be a little uneven. And one way of looking at enlightenment, at least how I would say it, is it's not them coming and saying, "Oh my God, you know, I feel awful, I must, you know, I have to do all these practices now to feel better again."
Mm-hmm.
And just being able to just flow with things and mm-hmm. realize that life has its ups and downs, and some days are the energy of the creative energy is much, it's not as exciting some days.
Well, this is just beautiful. I think this is the message of our day. And that as we sit around in spiritual fellowship like this, you know, and compare notes, that this is the most wonderful, pleasurable experience, everyday God, the democratization of enlightenment. So I really appreciate these moments, these mm-hmm. times. You know, my thought about, well, as I said before, just being with other like-minded people is the happy dynamic in which I think we can all relax and know that we've done our homework and see ourselves becoming ever freer, ever more able to sustain these things, not give ourselves a hard time while we don't. And I just think, Jim, your work is so emblematic of this way of being. We'll have a link on our page to your book so that people can buy it, The Way of Harmony. We'll have a link to Peter Russell. We're already linked to you, Peter, in other ways on the site. Also have a wonderful conversation about being awake where the email correspondence that Jim and I have been having is posted on the site. That's something new we're doing on the site. And my thought is that, you know, I'd love to be privy to these kind of conversations that other people are having. I don't have to be with them in the flesh. I can participate in that wonderful spiritual fellowship, hopefully by reading something like these email correspondences. And let me know, email me if these things are meaningful to you, and I will adjust my activity on the site according to what people tell me. But I think I'm doing something really nice there by making these things available. We don't really have places for...
You're bringing people together. I feel really... It was a gift to have you here. I mean, you've been a way show for me. You know, I remember reading your books and seeing what you're doing, thinking, God, I want to express myself like that. You know, so it's... you're the focal point. You're the energy. You know, you're the...
That's me, Suzanne, he's talking about, because you can't hear, you can't see him pointing right now.
The other me was me.
The other me was Peter, right?
Yeah, Suzanne is the energy that brings people like Peter and all these wonderful people that who come into your life, and I feel really honored and, you know, to be a part of that. And as the circle expands, not everybody writes books, you know, and those of us who write books and lecture, we're just instruments of the divine wisdom to communicate what consciousness wants communicated to people. And then somebody else maybe just takes care of a garden. That's all. I have a friend, Joseph, who was just getting back from another 6 months in India this month, and he's been with all his major teachers, Punjaji, and Joseph is a simple gardener. He's a beautiful man, and hanging out with Joseph is like drinking from the source. It's people like that, and he touches people. I went to his birthday, and there were so many people, like friends I didn't even know he had, and they're all drawn by his beauty and his simplicity and his genuine humility.
Well, those of us who get touched by this wisdom really just want to turn around and share it, and whatever our bent is, he's the gardener and the convener, you know.
Yeah.
I love my role. I mean, I feel like I don't know how it happened, but I certainly know what I'm, you know, sort of here for. And at that level of performance, you know, what am I up to? I love the thought that I can be the meeting place and the playing field. I can offer the playing field for wonderful occasions like this. So, until we meet again, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you, both of you.
Thank
you. See you all next time.
Thank you for listening to theconversation.org, Making Sense of These Times. Now that you've heard from us, we'd love to hear from you. Click the feedback button on the show's webpage and share your thoughts. We'll be posting new shows approximately once a week. If you would like to be emailed when new shows are posted, let us know. This show is brought to you by MightyCompanions.org, dedicated to encouraging the awareness of ourselves as a one life and providing a meeting ground for those who share that awareness.